Welcome to Oncology Today, Understanding Toxicities Associated with CAR T-Cell Therapy. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Matthew Lunning from the University of Nebraska Fred and Pamela Buffett Cancer Center in Omaha, Nebraska. To begin our conversation, I reflected back on a time period prior to the inception of CAR T therapy and asked Dr. Lunning for his insights on how far we've come. I get these flashbacks in my brain, and I thought about two experiences I've had, one recent and one a while back. So the recent one was we did a program on CAR T actually in NHL, and as part of the program, I got to do one-on-one video recordings with eight people who'd received CAR T, who were all in complete remission, anywhere from a year to 7 years, believe it or not. And so that was kind of flashing in my mind. And the other thing that was flashing in my mind, I don't remember when it was, I guess it was at least 10 years ago, was I had the opportunity to talk to Dr. David Porter from my alma mater at Penn, where I went to medical school, and I hadn't really been talking to many people at Penn since then. And at that time, CAR T was just coming out of Penn. Carl June, of course, was out there, and he told me this wild story I remember about a young girl, I think in her teens, who had this, he got beeped in the middle of the night. She was having, you know, CRS, I guess. They didn't know what CRS was. So from my point of view, I was kind of flashing from point A with David Porter to point B, talking to all these people who are now in complete remission. And I'm just curious how you reflect back on this time period from the very beginning when we really didn't know what to expect to now where we're talking about doing outpatient.
Yeah, no, I had the fortunate experience of being in fellowship when CAR T-cell was at its front door also. I trained at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and I got the opportunity to work with Dr. Rainier Brentjens, and, you know, through his clinic, got to experience some of the first patients treated with CD19 CAR there also. And, you know, it kind of reflects back to my experience of the excitement, but the, you know, worry about what the syndrome was. You know, people were trying to name cytokine release syndrome. People were trying to understand. And there were also the uncertainties of how to treat it, right? If you gave steroids, did you kill the CAR? You know, but I remember with one of my attendings at that time said, well, you can't cure somebody who's not alive, right? And I remember very vividly that experience sitting in the ICU, having that discussion with him. And to this day, that has stuck with me when I think about management of CRS and ICANS, right? From those fearful moments of people being on ventilators and pressors, you know, to where we've come now, you know, that's just, you know, the Dr. Porters, the Dr. Brentjens, you know, we have them, the people who really were the pioneers, you know, not only in the lab, but the pioneers that existed in the clinic, really to help, you know, galvanize the structure that allowed us to do this not as a boutique therapy, right? And that was the fear at the beginning, was that this is going to be a boutique therapy that could be done in four centers, not in the middle of the Midwest, you know, here in, you know, Omaha, but even in the communities that we're now talking about, you know, as smaller communities trying to do, you know, cellular therapy as we get better and better at doing it.
Yeah, you know, I was a little bit shocked when you put up the data there on second cancers, and I saw they looked at 42,000 people. This is 2024.
Right.
You got in CAR T. I'm like, I didn't realize that many people had gotten CAR T.
Yeah, so that was European data, and that's actually, you know, impressive numbers. I agree, and it's with the, you know, it's where this has become a global, you know, environment to have these discussions, not only about how we're doing risk mitigation, but also what are the long-term outcomes that we're kind of seeing, and you know, generating that data should give us a little bit of comfort, but it still should give us a little bit of pause, right? As we, you know, try to extend the boundaries of where cellular therapy can go, not only in oncology, but outside of oncology.
So let's get into some of the granularity of this topic, which is, there's a lot of it. So one thing I'm just curious, if you could just kind of go back and review exactly what happens with CAR T and what the exact mechanism of action is. And while you're at it, can you also address how do corticosteroids affect all the pathways involved? And you also hear questions about corticosteroids with, you know, checkpoint inhibitors as well.
Yeah, so I personally always like to go back from an intent to CAR standpoint, Dr. Love, if I could, because I think that it's only appropriate to acknowledge that the time that it starts is the time when the patient, the caregiver team, and you as the CAR T cell team agree to move forward with CAR T cell. Because I think that the brain to vein time that exists between actually that moment to actually getting apheresis is the true denominator impact of CAR T. And if we don't acknowledge that time frame, then we're not acknowledging all of those patients who could potentially benefit from this therapy. And in the clinical trials, that population was not in there, right? And so in the real world experience, they are absolutely in there. And I would encourage any of you that are doing real world data to try and approach CAR T cell from that lens, right? The clock starts when everybody has their hand in the middle to move forward. The vein-to-vein time has become very standard, right, in the commercial environment. We're trying to improve upon that vein-to-vein time of when the T-cells are pulled out to when the CAR T-cells are reinfused, right? And that's very product-specific. And there's, I think we've gotten, at least in the commercial product, really set timeframes that they've been able to wiggle off about 2 days, but really we're looking at 2 to 3 weeks there. You know, and that encompasses that lymphodepleting chemotherapy period of time. And we really haven't seen a lot of fludarabine shortages lately, but we did have an experience where bendamustine was used a significant amount of a period of time and really had some learnings from that. Not only the TCCL experience at UPenn with bendamustine to where I think we can very politely and easily pivot to bendamustine in a pinch. Now, once the CAR T cells are infused, I'm a big proponent of starting the clock there, right? And really looking at cytokine release syndrome from time to infusion to time that it actually happens. And this probably more so comes because I grew up in a lysocell dominant environment. We had access to axi-cell in clinical trials and we had access to lysocell. And so we were at one of the few centers here at the University of Nebraska where we had both in clinical trials at the same time. And so we were able to kind of see what horse was running down the track and how it was running potentially differently. And what I learned from that is that axi-cell came out of the gate very quickly, right? And so you were often seeing cytokine release syndrome within the first 24 hours of infusion that, you know, often went from grade 1 to grade 2 very quickly, and we were using TOSI and DEX in a high percentage of patients. Whereas with lysocell, we saw a little bit of a slower uptick of CRS. So fevers, hypotension, not always happening within that first 72 hours. But if it did happen in that first 72 hours, I was much more amenable to do something about it than just monitor grade 1 CRS. And I think that has really stuck with me because the learnings from there really became a blur, right? It was a blur because CRS manifests as ICANS, and that's typically by a whole slew of cytokines, often driven by interleukin-6, as well as TNF-alpha and other cytokines, but we can't get back in a real time, like quick-like fashion. But we also saw them parallel by a high rise in CRP and a high rise in ferritin, right? When you gave tocilizumab, what you saw very quickly was a quick reduction and an abrogation or bringing to normal the CRP, but the ferritin trailed behind. And so you kind of knew that you were sponging up or blocking, depending upon the IL-6 antagonist that you were using, whether or not it was tocilizumab. And some people have explored ciltuximab, which works in a different IL-6 type of a mechanism. Now, getting to your steroids, you know, we really were trying to learn how and when to use steroids and why to use steroids early earlier on, because it appeared that maybe, you know, these IL-6 antagonists didn't get across the blood-brain barrier. And so that downstream ICANS was probably more of a sink, right? Those therapies couldn't get there. And so you wanted to really intervene early in order to not allow a big surge of IL-6 to cross the blood-brain barrier. And when you're starting to think about utilizing steroids, really you're trying to slow the CAR T cell down, right? I always use the analogy of pulling, you know, gas and brake. So you've got to have a little gas to get the CAR T cells to do, but you have to have a little bit of a break to keep them on the track, right? You don't want them to stall out on the racetrack, but you don't also want them flying like Ricky Bobby style off the in turn number four and crashing. And so that's a big gas and a break. And that's what I think we've learned over the last decade of driving CAR T cells around this racetrack.
So one other thing I want to ask you about as we kind of shift our emphasis to talk about NHL. So just before we get into the specifics, there's kind of an interesting question we've been asking investigators about CAR T in NHL, which is if you or a clinical investigator would say, oh, that's a good situation. This is a patient that ought to be evaluated for CAR T. We ask people, of all the people who you would say should be evaluated for CAR T, how many in the United States are actually getting to the point of having the evaluation? And then once they do get to a CAR T center for evaluation, how many of them actually get CAR T? And I don't remember another time in oncology where we saw such a difference. I hear people saying, you know, maybe only a quarter of people who they would give CAR T to are actually being referred for CAR T. Do you agree with that number and what's behind all that?
Yeah, I think that this really comes back to my first point around intent to CAR, right? The clock starts at our institution when the referral happens, not when I see the whites of their eyes a lot of times, you know, and it doesn't start only in the population that you apheresed, right? And so I think that's, you know, and I'm at an authorized treatment center. I'm not out in the community, right? So that's why when my cell phone rings, you know, it's when can I get them in next, right? And it's often everyday matters. And so I'm trying to get them in next week. You know, I'm only one health system. I'm only one authorized treatment center, right? And so in that regard, I just fear that the access from referral from, you know, a community center that doesn't have access to CAR T cell to when they can get the CAR T cell is really where there's a sizable opportunity, right, in this population of patients to help improve the access. Because if you can shave off the days there, you often shave off the days from that standpoint of getting them to the CAR T cell. We've also have an opportunity because we have better agents now, I think, in that pre-apheresis time point to really control the volume of disease. And so I think there had been a lot of literature saying that if you got bridging therapy, you were going to do worse. You know, I think that really we need to rethink that sentiment and be a little bit more open to pre-apheresis bridging therapy to really control the disease. Or as my friend down in Florida at Moffitt there, Dr. Locke likes to say, holding therapy, you know, from that standpoint of how do we keep the disease under control at a minimum disease state, but not give them something that causes them to not be CAR T cell eligible because of the therapy that we gave. So that's why I leaned into, you know, Gemox, Pola-R, you know, something that we know they're in 2 weeks, they will recover their counts and the likelihood of them being sicker, you know, is less likely because we know that this is a chemo refractory patient population. And so I don't give a lot of RDHAP or ICE, you know, like was done in Zuma 7 specifically in Transform as a pre kind of post apheresis bridging therapy. I am using a lot more radiation and the post apheresis bridging therapy to help kind of stay away from my ineffective chemotherapy cocktails.
So I guess one of the things I'm curious about, since we're involved with continuing education, is, you know, clearly there are a lot of logistic issues in actually getting a patient in for a referral. Maybe there are travel issues, economic issues, et cetera. But my question is, do you feel that in general, when you look at community-based medical oncologists, they're aware of when and what situations they ought to be thinking about CAR T? And also, do you think their perception of the bar for entry is on target? Or do you think that maybe they kind of think it's similar to, say, what the kind of performance status, comorbidities, et cetera, for autologous transplants, that they overestimate the degree of fitness needed?
Yeah, no, I think that it's been very clear over at least the last 5 years that transplant eligibility and CAR T cell eligibility are not the same thing. If anything, I think that the bar has been raised for auto transplant in large cell lymphoma widened for CAR T cell in large cell lymphoma, and therefore the trickle down impact for follicular lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, CLL, SLL, so on and so forth. I do think that there is a sweet spot, in my opinion. You know, I do interim scans for large B-cell lymphoma prior to cycle 5 or prior to cycle 4. And if those individuals aren't in a complete metabolic response, that's a big red flag for me from that standpoint and for primary refractory disease. So if you are doing interim scans and you aren't a interim metabolic CR, then that would be kind of introducing the CAR T-cell or saying, hey, you know, maybe we should have you be seen at a CAR T-cell center to get established. Because, you know, while I'm hoping that your disease won't be primary refractory, and if it is, that's great, but you're probably at a higher risk of being primary refractory or having early relapse disease. I do think that there's an opportunity also to potentially engage around minimal residual disease assays. Even if you're if you're a Deauville 4, those Deauville 4s can be hard to know what to do. And sometimes the biopsy sites are not amenable to biopsy. And how can you use and how should we be using? I think it's an ongoing discussion, these minimal residual disease techniques to help enhance our radiographic imaging and get people with less amounts of disease to CAR T cell, because I do think size matters. I think that is one of the biggest barriers that we learned from the relapse refractory space from Zuma 1 and Transcend, was that bulky, a lot of disease can be impactful to durability of response.
So I'm going to get more specific about the use of CAR T in general in the three common non-Hodgkin lymphoma scenarios. But first, if we could just begin with kind of an indirect comparison of the three available products in terms of time to preparation, efficacy, and also toxicity, particularly acute toxicity. This project where I chatted with these 8 patients, we also did a survey of investigators that you participated in. And I've got to say that I was a little bit surprised to see the current thinking, and I'm curious if you want to comment on it. Again, just comparing the three products, I kind of had this impression that people thought that AxiCell had greater efficacy. But when we did this recent poll, I got more of an impression that there wasn't much difference in efficacy, that maybe there was a quicker time for preparation for AxiCell, more cytokine release and ICANS with AxiCell, but not necessarily greater efficacy. Am I reading that correctly?
I mean, that's unfortunately, the time has passed where we're going to have a CAR versus CAR study of a CD19 versus CD19, you know, so it's all going to be based upon kind of opinion, I think, here. And we're really living in these real world experience eras, and we're probably going to see more of those at this year's ASH, you know, from that standpoint. And I do think I agree with you, Dr. Love, with regards to, you know, undoubtedly AxiCell vein to vein is faster than lysocell, right? And I think one of the other areas where there was a lot of discussion is around out-of-spec products, right? With regards to AxiCell having a higher in-spec rate than lysocell. But I think that gap has also been closed by lysocell, you know, to where it now, I believe the data is 93% are in-spec, 6 are out-of-spec, and 1% are manufacturing failures, if I'm remembering my data correctly. In the eyes of of me as the provider giving the CAR T-cell, that 6%, I have an expanded access protocol that gets likely access to those out-of-spec products, just like I do for AxiCell. T-cell, I think, is one that does have a little bit longer manufacturing time in the vein-to-vein time, even though they've been improving upon it with their different iterations. I've primarily focused my practice on lysocell and AxiCell from that standpoint, and really looked at more the grade 3 ICANS or neurotoxicity and worked my way backwards. So without a efficacy difference, with a what I'm arguing is a marginal difference in the vein-to-vein time, understanding that I just said in the prior call, you know, every day matters, but every day matters across the landscape of the CAR T-cell, right? From the length of hospitalization, from the resource utilization, you know, aspect. And without efficacy data, I'm going to try to take a less toxic product that arguably has as good of a time to get into a CR. Understanding that our own internal data doesn't suggest that in that post-apheresis timeframe, we're losing a substantial amount of patients, right? And so I at least have my own internal data to help kind of get comfortable with. And I think that when you hear different institutional landscape. It's around the landscape, right? It's what they got comfortable with and what the operational infrastructure got comfortable with. And you really had to make a very serious decision of, do you learn one well, right? And both from an operation standpoint, a infusion standpoint, and then a post-CAR T-cell standpoint, when there isn't randomized head-to-head trial to guide you one way or the other from that standpoint. And then you can build around the CAR T-cell, trying to improve upon your own internal capabilities.
So what about the older patient in their late 70s? What's the oldest patient you've given CAR T for NHL? And can you comment a little bit about your preference? Is liso-cel in general what you're preferring in general, or more in older patients?
Yeah, my preference is liso-cel to be given kind of in the older age individuals. You know, I think we've comfortably done 80-year-olds with liso-cel, and I've done have done that. And I'd love to have a CAR T-cell pageant where, you know, you ask your CAR T-cell patients, you know, to walk across the stage, you know, and they are walking, you know, across the stage. They're not in a wheelchair. They're not with their walker. They may have been in a wheelchair and a walker immediately post CAR T cell, but those people still evolve to get back to the quality of life that they wanted, you know, after CAR T cell. And I think that is something that we should be promoting is that level of visibility for our CAR T cell patients. You know, not that at 70 you can't have it. You know, because if you're 69, you can, and 71, you can't. From that standpoint, I lean heavily on the pilot data that I presented here today, kind of because it went after that over age of 70. It went after those patients who had other comorbid conditions, and really, I think, expanded the ability to say, well, yeah, I can take a person who has a creatinine clearance of 45 as long as I adjust, you know, for their, you know, their fludarabine dose. I can take a well-compensated patient with HFrEF or congestive heart failure, you know, through a CAR T-cell. But I'm having the conversation with them, too, about what are the alternatives beyond CAR T-cell. It's not CAR T-cell for everybody. It's a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma relapse refractory setting conversation for everybody, because really that space has become, you know, a giant space with the, you know, with bispecifics and bispecific combinations now starting to enter into the mix.
Yeah, and I want to get into that in a second, but just to pick up there again on choice of CAR T, if you have a younger, you know, 60-year-old patient, no other comorbidities, assuming they don't need treatment immediately, the time, you know, to treatment is not a critical issue, Would they get liso-cel also, or they get axi-cel?
Yeah, no, I again, just sticking to the grade 3-4 ICANS, right? If I have a lower risk of having grade 3-4 ICANS, I still think that is a, you know, not only for the, nobody should want to experience grade 3-4 ICANS. And so I think that was the whole impetus behind Zuma 24. It was a whole impetus behind Zuma 1 cohort 6, you know, in regards to that, is to try to, with prophylactic steroids, risk mitigate that grade 3-4 ICANS. And arguably it brought it down, but it didn't bring it down substantially. And so I still do use liso-cel in that patient population, short of a clinical trial, you know, which I would gladly have put people on to help answer that question. But that ship has sailed.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask you another question that we could probably spend an hour talking about, but maybe you can just sort of capsulize it, which is starting out with diffuse large B-cell, then going to follicular lymphoma, then going to mantle cell. Can you talk a little bit about when you think about using CAR T, and particularly the issue of what comes first, a bispecific or CAR T, and then which CAR T in general you think about?
Yeah, so I will tackle large cell lymphoma first. You know, I think that as I alluded to, you know, we're starting to see trials now that if you're not in a PET CR after four cycles, people are considering that primary refractory disease and allowing them to go on to CAR T cells. So I think that the field is in evolution as we get you know, better and better data around, you know, the size of the CAR T cell matters, and you know, pissing off the T cells, you know, with more and more chemotherapy matters also. You know, we have an upfront randomized trial with Zuma 23 of chemotherapy versus axi-cel. I think so. CAR T cell is on the march. You know, I do think that bispecifics are likely to leapfrog it, though, with bispecifics moving into the frontline CAR T cell landscape and CAR T cell being parked still in second line primary refractory or early relapsing disease. But I think we're creating a whole different landscape when if bispecifics do hit in that frontline setting, because we're now creating a bispecific exposed in a population that we don't have a lot of data for with regards to the outcomes and the manufacturing fidelity of the CAR T cells in that population. So, you know, there's a big asterisk there, right? And this is current state, but I'm already, my mind, you know, is future focused in regards to we're going to start to see those patients who have prior bispecific and frontline large B-cell lymphoma, because guess what? People participate in the EPCO R-CHOP and people participated in the GLOFIT POLA R-CHIP randomized trials. And thank you for doing that. But we've got to be informing the commercial CAR T cells that these patients' last line of therapy was a bispecific 3 months ago, 6 weeks ago, you know, to help guide them on what they're seeing, you know, in the manufacturing lab. With regards to, I'm going to move to from aggressive to least aggressive and jump to mantle cell lymphoma. Mantle cell lymphoma is a different beast in general with CAR T cells, in my opinion. You know, they are at higher risk for CRS, early CRS, higher risk for ICANS. And I think that it is something to do with that there's just an occult circulating disease that's present. You know, so these CAR T cells are snatching them or earlier in circulation. And so the CRS and the ICANS is happening earlier, and I argue it is at higher degrees. And now we see that not only if you go axi-cel to bruxy-cel, granted manufacturing differences, but you see that with lysocell also, right? So lysocell in large cell lymphoma is not the same. It's the same manufactured lysocell, but it tastes differently in the relapse refractory mantle cell lymphoma space. I am right now putting CAR T cell after a BTK. You know, and so, you know, that does, you know, hinge on that, you know, if you're giving BTK up front and the patient has an early relapse, right, it's second line. Well, right now, based upon the label, I have to use bruxy-cel in that setting. And so, you know, if it is second line, I may choose to use bruxy-cel, but I use it with the caveat that I think, you know, it is has a higher risk of CRS and a higher risk of high-grade neurotoxicity. If it's second line or more relapse refractory, then I am using lysocell, but I am still talking about that. I think it is, you know, a little bit more toxic from a CRS ICANS standpoint. But I do think that BTK inhibitors kind of should come before a CAR T cell here. And I'm saying that because I do use a lot of BTK in my TP53 patients who are getting Bovin or some other additional regimen with the CD20 and a BCL2 inhibitor. In a frontline TP53 mutated mantle cell lymphoma. Now, speaking to follicular lymphoma, you know, that's a really interesting area because that's where bispecifics are likely going to come before CAR T cell, at least in my clinic. Now that we know that EPCO R squared, you know, beat R squared, we have, you know, EPCO single agent data and two lines and beyond with both EPCO and Mosin. And we're seeing a lot of, you know, frontline follicular trials. If you look at, you know, kind of Morning Sun and other trials where bispecifics are before it. So we're probably going to learn the real world experience on the efficacy of a bispecifics and then CAR T cell in follicular lymphoma before we will in large B cell lymphoma. That being said, you know, I think that's okay in this landscape. But I don't know that we have a lot of data in the approval of the CAR T cells in relapse refractory follicular lymphoma. There was not a lot of patients exposed to bispecifics there.
And which CAR T do you generally use with follicular?
With follicular, I kind of stay with the operationally and programmatically. Mostly, we're using lysocell in that landscape also.
So, you know, kind of follicular sort of sneaked up on me. I mean, again, I'm in the general population. Initially, I kind of had that feeling that wasn't really relevant, you know, that's a slowly developing disease, the bispecifics are so effective. And then I started to look at the data with CAR T and follicular. It's pretty impressive. Not to mention it's kind of a one and done thing too, which is great for the patient. I kind of wonder whether or not it's underestimated in terms of its value. You tell me though, how valuable do you think it is in these patients?
I think it's appropriately valued in follicular lymphoma because one of the things around that is it's the unknown, right? We don't have a lot of bispecific and then CAR T cell data in follicular lymphoma, right? You're absolutely right, Dr. Love. The CAR T cell data with follicular lymphoma, with axi-cel, with tisa-cel, with lysa-cel, it looks great, right? And when you pay attention to CAR T cells, you should pay attention to CR rates, right? But there's also, you know, with the follicular lymphoma, you need to wait a little bit longer, right? Large cell lymphoma, you know, you're like, oh, day 30, day 100. But really with follicular lymphoma, it's really 3 months and 6 months, you know, that you're really looking for. And then you've, you know, in order to see the true potential of CAR T-cell and follicular lymphoma, it's really, you've got to look at 5-year data, right? You're not focusing on 2-year data like we often do with our large cell lymphoma and mantle cell CAR T-cells from that standpoint. So I think that where I'm using CAR T-cell and follicular lymphoma is like that follicular lymphoma that I know clinically is transforming, right? But I've been throwing darts in them trying to get, you know, a transform follicular lymphoma, and it just keeps coming back follicular lymphoma. But the PET scan and the biology is telling me it's different.
Can you just review what the REMS standards were before and what they are and what the standards are right now coming out of the FDA with CAR T?
Yeah, so with regards to the REMS program, you know, we had to as a group of people that were either going to handle or prescribe these therapies, you had to go through a set of tests and quizzes, if you will, that were brought down by the manufacturers themselves. And I believe the way REMS works is either a manufacturer can say that they're going to do a REMS, or the government can ask you to have a REMS in place. And you can, you know, ask that the REMS be removed, but I think that you have to come with data, or the FDA can remove it also in you know, in spite of data. From that standpoint, I really think that this REMS was driven by data. And I think that that's great that we just weren't just satisfied, right? We understood that this therapy wasn't getting to everybody. And could we generate data that supported, you know, getting rid of the REMS and get rid of these arbitrary 8 weeks to no driving and you know, you have to be within this close, when we know if you're on a Friday afternoon in Manhattan at Penn Station, to get to 76th in York could take you 2 hours in an ambulance, but it could take you 30 minutes to go 30 miles in other places. So, you know, I think it gave a lot of more flexibility and put the decision in the hands of the authorized treatment centers to kind of make the call and really use the patient's clinical course to help guide you, rather than these very black and white type of situations, which CAR T cell is always gray.
So a couple other points you made. One I hadn't heard before: morning infusions of CAR T cells. What's the presumed pathophysiology? You kind of made an allusion to circadian rhythm, but what do we know about this and why?
Well, it's just starting. You know, I try to tickle some of the viewers' neurons here, you know, because trying to stay up to date, because this is something that I just heard kind of hot off the wire, and we're trying to recapitulate that data in ourselves, because we are just by happenstance happen to be a morning CAR T cell infusing center. And so we're going back even into our data sets to kind of look like, is this real? And I think that's one of the beauties of medical education, is kind of you're flipping through something and you're like, really? Like, was this done with multivariate analyses and all these things? And so, you know, I'm not saying you've got to change your processes, but, you know, these are the weird things about the immune system that we never really thought about, right? I'm not saying that it's a one and done. It's just one variable along the way, but it's a simple variable to move if it's true. Right. If it's true that by giving CAR T cell between 8 and 10 reduces your risk of having CRS and ICANS, I mean, that's not a heavy lift for a health system to think about.
Absolutely. So another thing that you talked about and I've heard about, and I just kind of still like to hear more about it, is, you know, the neurologic issues you see that kind of go beyond ICANS. And you talked about this Parkinsonian thing that's been seen with cilta-cel and myeloma. But, you know, a couple of these patients that I spoke with for this program who didn't have myeloma. They got, a CAR T for NHL, I think diffuse large B-cell. A couple of them had tremors and other symptoms that they kind of said well, it's kind of like Parkinson's. Do you see this? First of all, what's the mechanism? I heard that, you know, I don't know if it's toxicity to the substantia nigra or whatever. And do you see this with CD19 CAR T?
You know, so I didn't quite make it into the to the Lee criteria for neurotoxicity, but I've certainly seen, I'm always asking about headaches and asking about tremors, right? Especially in people who are having CRS is kind of like the early lean into, you know, not to be go on rounds, be a soothsayer, but you're like, that person's going to have ICANS this evening, you know, type of things, because there are subtleties that you can see. And there are certain, you know, tremors that could come out that may come after CAR T cell, but they're incredibly subtle. And you know, it's kind of, we need to be good clinicians on the pre CAR T cell, because sometimes these aren't noticed. Or you know, you see them sometimes in auto transplants too. As the patient is more advanced age, as they get weaker, certain things come out when they're weaker than versus when they're stronger, just from a muscle tone, from a performance status standpoint. And so it's hard to tease out what is truly neurotoxicity and a tremor versus what is just kind of a baseline and a kind of performance status related condition that will resolve over time. From that standpoint, I certainly think there's some cognitive, delay that comes with post-CAR T cell. You know, people will say, you know, I used to know that 2 + 2 = 4. Now it's 2 + 2 = 4, right? It's like, I can get there. It just takes me a little bit longer to get there, right? In the kind of the mind and the thought process post-CAR T cell.
All right, well, let's get into your cases here, beginning with this 80-year-old woman.
Yeah, so this is a fun case. So this is an 80-year-old woman who had primary refractory large B-cell lymphoma after Pola-R-CHP. So as I was alluding to, we're starting, you know, as Polarix is kind of making its way into the marketplace here, we're starting to see these patients that are primary refractory. Because she was primary refractory, had disease, and I'm a believer in the size of the disease matters, I'm often, depending upon the time from seeing them to getting them apheresed, I do use Gemox as a form of therapy in the pre-apheresis period of time. She gets our Gemox and does very well, and her adenopathy stabilizes with that therapy. Post-apheresis, she gets boom-boom radiotherapy. And so we had a clinical trial of 2 × 2 that they could have been enrolled into from that standpoint. And then they received lysocell. And the boom-boom was given up to 6 sites. Again, just 2 × 2. So goes on to get lysocell. Post-apheresis at day +2. Again, I alluded to that timing matters. And with regards to lysocell, back in the original clinical trials, you were kind of instructed to think about doing something differently if the CRS happened within 72 hours of infusion. So this individual had fevers requiring IV fluids for hypotension. So that would be a grade 2 CRS. They responded to their IV fluids. But nevertheless, because it was grade 2, they were given TOCI × 1 and DEX × 1 with complete resolution of her symptoms. Okay. And so this is very, very common with CRS is that they're kind of feel like flu-like symptoms. They're bedbound. They feel crummy. They have their CRS. They get TOCI, DEX, and they're out walking the halls in the afternoon. Unfortunately, 2 days later, day +4, she experiences altered mental status. She has an ICE at 6-7 out of 10 or grade 2, and she gets treated with 10 BID of dexamethasone, and we initiated Keppra, and her altered mental status stabilized initially. However, next day, her altered mental status worsened, and she had an ICE of 0 out of 10, but aroused to voice. And so again, kind of now worsening ICANS. We start an advanced 10Q4 of DEX, but because of the time frame, this is where I'm leaning into this steroid refractory or steroid progressive ICANS. We did go straight to starting 7 days of anakinra and intrathecal triple therapy from utilizing the data from my Medical College of Wisconsin colleagues. And because I'm a believer that the time spent in high-grade ICANS matters, right, because it cuts down on the amount of steroids that these patients get. There's MD Anderson data that showed that the patients who got more steroids, which is often driven by their CRS and ICANS, did worse from an infection standpoint. So in this patient's case, within 2 days, her ulcer mental status improves. By day 9, her ulcer mental status resolved, and now her ICE is 10 out of 10. And fortunately, at day 15, she's discharged to an acute rehab facility, of which she graduates very quickly thereafter and has a day 28 metabolic CR.
So what's the current status of this patient?
In complete remission, is kind of one of those situations of in the hospital, the neurotoxicity or ICANS really set them back. And then, they've improved very, very quickly from day 14 and beyond and did not have any recurrence of their neurotoxicity or their CRS. And we do an early day 29 PET CT, then we'll do a day 100 PET CT to confirm complete remission.
And how long has it been since you got the CAR T?
I believe they're in between that day 29 and day 100 scan currently.
Oh, so it's a short term then. Yep. So a couple questions I wanted to ask you before. You were talking about bridging therapy. And I'm curious, when you reduce the tumor bulk, what impact that has on CRS, on ICANS, and also these Parkinsonian issues?
So in regards to large cell lymphoma, I do believe that there is data to suggest that more tumor burden or total metabolic tumor burden may impact the long-term efficacy of the CARs. So as we've gotten better therapies and as we've been able to kind of focus on catching large cell lymphoma early before it's symptomatic, and then controlling the disease burden, I think matters. And I think that this is why gentle therapies or these therapies that meant to stabilize and keep the disease at a minimum, whether or not it's GemOx or utilizing radiotherapy, can be important downstream and be impactful to not only reducing our risk mitigating for CRS and ICANS, but also helping patients achieve CR and those CRs being durable.
So getting back to the return to sender idea that you were talking about, when was it this lady got discharged from the CAR T center to go back to the community? And also, is it true that the updated monitoring for patients now, I think you mentioned it focuses on the first 2 weeks?
Yes.
And also same thing in terms of driving. They only have to avoid driving for 2 weeks?
Yeah, so that's true. And in this situation with a patient who has ICANS, I'm a little more conservative, right? I want to see kind of a full 2 weeks of improvement to day 28 before they're begging to get back to driving between day 14 and day 28. In regards to that, this was a local patient, so it wasn't necessarily that I was sending them back to Ord, Nebraska, from that standpoint. And so we have to be still conscientious of distance, right? So for instance, just to give you a little leaning into Nebraska geography, right? If you're from Ord, Nebraska, that could still be, an hour and a half to your community oncologist. And from the community oncologist, it can still be 2 hours to Omaha, right? So all of this is just guidance, right? This isn't mandates. This isn't policy. So we still have to use our neurons in order to, think about the patient's condition and understand that this is a very fluid situation, not a static situation.
All right, let's hear about your second case, a 60-year-old man.
All right, so this is a 60-year-old man with TP53 mutated advanced stage mantle cell lymphoma. Remember, 10% of mantle cell lymphoma is TP53 mutated. 0% of it is TP53 mutated if you don't assess it. And I think in 2025, certainly we should be looking for TP53 mutated mantle cell lymphoma. This patient is given the Bovin regimen. For those of you who don't know Bovin, Bovin is Zanubrutinib, obinutuzumab, and venetoclax, which is now listed in the NCCN guidelines. And my friend and colleague, Dr. Kumar, gets the opportunity to inform us on the update of Bovin from her clinical trial. Unfortunately, this individual progresses while on Bovin at the 18 month of therapy. So quickly, I knew this was not a good situation. And so pre and post apheresis, I rolled them into pirtobrutinib. And I think it's incredibly important that mantle cell lymphoma is not CLL. So we should be checking or doing response evaluations periodically in these patients who are on dual oral therapies, you know, from that standpoint, again, trying to catch these mantle cell lymphomas when the disease is minimal. Because, you know, the learnings in mantle cell lymphoma that I think are unique here is that 10% of the disease is progressing on their BTK inhibitor. When you stop the BTK inhibitor and don't know what you're going to do, 100% of the patient's disease is progressing. And these patients become symptomatic very quickly. And so do not stop the covalent BTK unless you have access to the non-covalent BTK or a plan of what to do next. Okay. And so I was very strategic in continuing the therapy until I knew what we were going to do next. We rolled quickly into pirtobrutinib, hoping to control the disease, understanding that the data supports that when in covalent BTK refractory patients in the BRUIN 321 trial, those refractory patients that rolled over to non-covalent BTK, I don't have much clinical confidence in this situation that this patient was going to have a long-term disease stabilization period. And so I was already having discussions about we're doing pirto to bruxycel. Again, kind of leaning into the intent. I try to count in regards to lines of therapy. And so a young person get on a covalent BTK for disease stabilization and then rolling him into bruxycel. So again, trying to have the least amount of disease burden going into it, which I think would hope decrease the risk of CRS and ICANS and hopefully increase, you know, their chances of long-term disease-free survival. So this person gets bruxycel after standard lymphodepleting chemotherapy. And as expected in mantle cell lymphoma, they have a fever within the first 24 hours of infusion. They get IV fluids for their hypotension. They're treated with TOCI and DEX with resolution. Unfortunately, you know, shortly thereafter, and this is also common, they develop altered mental status by in the morning and their ICE is a 0 out of 10 and they have no improvement with high dose methylprednisolone. Okay. So this is where ICANS goes from, you know, walking and talking to almost a coma-like state very quickly. And it can be incredibly scary for the family. The patient doesn't remember all of this. You know, when they wake up, it's like waking up from your colonoscopy, you know, after getting fentanyl, you're counting backwards, 10, 9, you have the procedure. It's 8, 7, 6 when you wake up. This is exactly what happens with the CAR T-cell patients. They think it's Monday and they wake up, it's Tuesday. And like, no, it's Saturday, you know, from that standpoint. We did start anakinra and IT triple therapy and engaged our neuro consultants here just because of how quickly they had the onset of ICANS and for continuous EEG. Day 3, there were evidence of seizures, but they were controlled with anti-epileptics. Day plus 7. And what I've seen in these profound, rapid CRS and ICANS events is that they have prolonged and low cytopenias here. I think it's just a crescendo and a shocked bone marrow type of situation. All the stars aligned with regards to lymphodepleting chemotherapy hitting its peak, as well as just CRS and ICANS at a high degree, causing kind of a prolonged cytopenia. So this person's supported with antibacterials, antivirals, and then we do azole with mold coverage in this situation because of the duration of steroids, as well as the use of tocilizumab and anakinra. So over 7 days, their altered mental status slowly resolves, but their ANC remains 0. We started growth factor, and they were requiring occasional red cell and platelet transfusions. This individual did have a slow recovery and discharged to an acute rehab facility with periodic G-CSF and transfusions. And at day 42, they're readmitted with evidence of fevers and bilateral pneumonia. Fortunately, their ANC had recovered, but they're started on IV antibiotics. And we looked and their IgG level was 200. And so after discharging from on an oral antibiotic regimen, they now are on monthly IVIG. So lessons learned here is that, cytopenias can happen, but always be on the lookout for a hypogammaglobulinemia coming out of the CAR T cell. And really, we've started to look before CAR T cell what the IgG level is going into CAR T cell.
So before we go into the last case, just kind of curious, if you could have given this same patient liso-cel, would you have? Was it just the approval that prevented you from doing that, or you think it's a better option to use bruxycel for this patient?
I would have probably, if I had ability to use Lysosel second line in mantle cell lymphoma, I likely would have here also.
All right, 63-year-old man.
So switching diseases, here this is a 63-year-old left-handed man. So if I say left-handed, it means he had a neurologic problem because a neurologist was involved, because you have to always describe handedness in a case report. With refractory multiple myeloma, ECOG form status 1, a no baseline neurologic deficits, goes on to receive cilta-cel after standard lymphodepleting chemotherapy. And not a lot of patients are being necessarily bridged. Kind of this pre and post apheresis. I haven't really seen a lot of that in the literature. It seems to be a kind of more of a lymphoma thing. Day 11, patient has grade 1 CRS and no ICANS. And I think this is a lesson learned about cilta-cel. It's kind of a boring 10 days. It seems like all the excitement happens after day 10. So anyways, day 11 has grade 1 CRS. Was monitored for 48 hours. Nothing really happens. Discharged at day 13. I think we're achieves a stringent CR by day 30. Presents at day 62 with a new unilateral facial weakness and difficulty closing the right eye. Presents to the emergency room. Neurology is consulted and confirmed a left cranial 7 palsy with no other neurologic deficits. Patient is admitted for further evaluation, MRI brain, lumbar puncture shows a negative CSF, infectious evaluation was negative. And so at the end of the day, diagnosis of exclusion is felt to be a delayed cranial nerve palsy associated with cilta-cel. Patient started on steroids, ocular protection is recommended and started on IVIG therapy. And what you see in this situation is gradual improvement over 6 to 8 weeks with mild residual weakness, and their myeloma remains in a stringent CR. So I think it kind of is fitting this pattern of Bell's palsy type processes. You know, I'm not sure we found a direct linker, you know, EBV or anything like that, kind of reactivation from that. And it kind of smells like a Bell's palsy-like phenomenon. Here, I didn't give a case of the Parkinsonian features, though, but I think that this is just another unique situation that I've encountered.
Is Bell's palsy or any cranial nerve palsy something that's been observed with CAR-T? To be kind of surprised me when you said that.
Yes. I think that cranial palsies have been seen post-CAR-T.
This concludes our program. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. Throughout this program, the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may have been discussed, so please check out the package inserts for more information. Special thanks to Dr. Lunning, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.